Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and thanks for joining the program. When you wake up in the morning, is your first thought, I want to get out of cyclic existence, and I want other sentient beings to get out of cyclic existence? Or is it mainly, how can I have pleasure while I'm here? What are most of your thoughts during the day concerned with? Is it how to get out of cyclic existence, or is it how to get as much pleasure as possible while we're here around? The well-known American nun Thupten Chodron poses these questions in her commentary to the text we've been following over the last 5 weeks, The Principal Aspects of the Path. And here I must make an apology. I realize that in previous programs I've said Pema Chodron instead of Thupten Chodron when quoting excerpts to illustrate points in the text. Pema Chodron is, of course, the nun whose commentary I used for the previous text we went through, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Thupten Chodron is the founder and abbess at Shravasti Abbey in Newport in the United States. You can find her teachings on www.thuptenchodron.org, and it's her commentary on the three principal aspects of the path that I'm quoting in these programs. I must apologize to both nuns and you, the listeners, for my mistake. But now to continue. If you were with us for the last program, you will remember we were discussing the verse in the text that went, For you embodied beings, bound by the craving for existence, without the pure determination to be free, that's renunciation, from the ocean of existence, there's no way for you to pacify the attractions to its pleasurable effects. Thus, from the outset, seek to generate the determination to be free. This verse relates to why we should develop renunciation, and Thupten Chodron made the point that unless we see the faults of cyclic existence, we will have no desire to escape it. What we're trying to do with renunciation is see the faults of cyclic existence because that gives us the energy to change the situation. This is actually one of the most difficult things for us to see in our practice, she writes. So her questions force us to look at our minds to see if we are really concerned with renunciation, the first of the three aspects, or not. Of course, as Buddhists, we all say we want to become enlightened. But actually, how much? What will we do to escape samsara? Will we make that desire to escape the driving force of our lives? Often we're too addicted to the pleasures of samsara to make that final commitment, and so here we stay, going on from one unsatisfactory life to another in endless cyclic existence. Now, before we go any further, let's set our motivation for the program as we usually do, thinking to develop a real horror of cyclic existence and the determination to escape, to become enlightened, not only for our own sake, but for all other beings also caught up in the cycle of suffering. Thank you. Now, if you've been with us over the last 5 weeks, and maybe even before that, you obviously have some renunciation, even if it's limited. Otherwise, you would have stopped listening a long time ago. Often people think that to have pure renunciation, you must necessarily live in a cave or a hut somewhere deep in the forest, far from the attractions of the worldly life. But that's not true. We can live a very everyday existence and still do everything to be free of cyclic existence. Which leads to the question then, what is cyclic existence? And Thupten Chodron has a good answer. She says, when they say what is cyclic existence, these aggregates, Our body and mind is cyclic existence. That's actually very important, because lots of the time we think cyclic existence is the environment. Like, I'm in cyclic existence. I want to get out of cyclic existence. So if I go from the city to the monastery, then I'm getting out of cyclic existence. Or I'm getting out of cyclic existence if I go to Nirvana, which is a few realms up in the sky somewhere. No, that's not it, she says. When we think like that, we're still holding on to the idea of a solid me based on this contaminated body and contaminated mind. If we want to be free of cyclic existence, it means shedding the contaminated five aggregates. We do that by freeing our mind from the causes of cyclic existence, the afflictions and the karma. We free our minds by realizing emptiness, because the way the wisdom perceiving emptiness sees things is exactly the opposite to the way ignorance sees things. When we generate the wisdom realizing emptiness, it directly contradicts the ignorance, and so it's able to overcome it. Samsara isn't our environment. Samsara is our contaminated body and mind. Geshe Sanam Rinchen has this to say about it. Without a strong drive to free yourself from cyclic existence, you will continue to desire the pleasures of the world. You may think, well, what's wrong with that? The quest to find happiness in these ordinary pleasures keeps you bound to worldly existence, and the satisfaction you seek will always elude you. Though craving itself is different from the basic misconception of the self, which lies at the root of our suffering, this thirst experienced by beings with bodies keeps us chained to suffering in every way. If you're carrying the wood of a prickly thorn tree on your naked back, no matter which way you turn to shift the load, you will never find a moment's comfort until you set it down. In our heart of hearts, we know that our present condition is uncomfortable. Wherever we travel, we're reminded of it, because sooner or later something goes wrong. Either we get sick or unhappy. No matter how great the luxury we enjoy or the excellent company we keep, misery of some kind dogs our footsteps. Now, if we want proof of this, we can turn to a survey titled Joys and Dilemma of Wealth, run by Boston College's Center on Wealth and Philanthropy and funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Caliber Wealth Management in 2011. The survey covered 165-odd households, 120 of which had a fortune of at least $25 million. The average net worth of the respondents to the survey, two of whom said they were billionaires, was $78 million. You may not expect, or perhaps you do, that the survey found that despite owning wealth, sometimes rivaling the GDP of a small country, many of the wealthy aren't all that happy. In his article on the survey for the Atlantic newspaper, Graham Wood reported, "The respondents turn out to be a generally dissatisfied lot whose money has contributed to deep anxieties involving love, work, and family. Indeed, they are frequently dissatisfied even with their sizable fortunes. Most of them still do not consider themselves financially secure. For that, they say, they would require, on average, one quarter more wealth than they currently possess." And remember, this is a population with assets in the tens of millions of dollars and above. One respondent, the heir to an enormous fortune, says that what matters most to him is his Christianity, and that his greatest aspiration is to love the Lord, my family, and my friends. He also reports that he wouldn't feel financially secure until he had $1 billion in the bank. Wood continues, "Among other woes, the survey respondents report feeling that they've lost the right to complain about anything for fear of sounding or being ungrateful. Those with children worry that their children will become trust fund brats if their inheritances are too large, or will be forever resentful if those inheritances or part of them are instead bequeathed to charity." The respondents also confide that they feel their outside relationships have been altered by, and in some cases become contingent on, their wealth. "Very few people know the level of my wealth, And if they did, in most cases, I believe it would change our relationship, writes one respondent. Another notes, I start to wonder how many people we know would cut us off if they didn't think they could get something from us. Robert A. Kenny, a psychologist, a counselor of the rich and one of the survey's architects, says that extreme wealth can take away the basic joys of living. For instance, that some wealthy people don't look forward to the holidays because they were always expected to give really good presents. When you're a millionaire, Kenny says, expensive gifts merely meet expectations. Oh, that was a pretty good present, the recipients might respond, but last year you gave me a car. Kenny says, sometimes I think that the only people in this country who worry more about money than the poor are the very wealthy. They worry about losing it, they worry about how it's invested, they worry about the effect it's going to have. And as the zeros increase, the dilemmas get bigger. And he also says of people who suddenly come into a lot of wealth, one of the saddest phrases I've heard is, honey, you're never going to have to work. The announcement is often made, Kenny explains, by a rich grandparent to a grandchild, and it really sounds as good to the person it is directed to as to the one delivering it. Work is what fills most people's days, and it provides the context in which they interact with others. A life of worklessness, however financially comfortable, can easily become one of aimlessness, of estrangement from the world. The fact that most people imagine it would be paradise to never have to work does not make the experience any more pleasant in practice. He also talks about how wealth affects the love life of the uber-rich. They worry about gold diggers, and one rich woman was concerned that her daughter's suitors would feel powerless as their role of provider had been usurped. Freud was right, says Kenny. Love and work are the two things you have to do in life. And great wealth, he says, often undermines both. But the biggest concern of the hugely rich, the survey found, is their children. Although wealth means the kids' education is well looked after, it easily gives them a perverted view of the world, as one respondent wrote. It robs them of ambition, gives them a sense of entitlement, and perhaps more importantly, prevents them from developing a strong sense of empathy and compassion. The parents want their kids to make wise choices, but realize that they have no control of what the kids decide to do. They don't think their kids are moral midgets, says Kenny. They just know there are not a lot of guideposts out there because the world thinks if you have all that money, you've got it made in the shade. And if you don't have it made in the shade, what the hell's the matter with you? Graham Wood, the author of the Atlantic article, writes, as they get older, many kids of privilege take either too many risks because they know the consequences of failure are minimal, or too few because they feel assured in their financial well-being. Kenny says they, like their parents, can grow bored with one line of work and make consequence-free shifts to other jobs, until finally they reach middle age and discover that they've put together the resume of a dabbler and haven't made the impact that they'd hoped. They get to be 50 years old, says Kenny, and all of a sudden they say to me, both in their love life and their work life, I have to stop hitting that reset button. Wood ends the article with these words. If anything, the rich stare into the abyss a bit more starkly than the rest of us. We can always indulge in the thought that a little more money would make our lives happier, and in many cases it's true. But the truly wealthy know that appetites for material indulgence are rarely sated. No yacht is so super, nor any wine so expensive, that it can soothe the soul or guarantee one's children won't grow up to be creeps. When the rich man takes his last sip of Chateau Yquem 1959, he tips back the wine glass to find at its bottom an unforeseen melancholy. Like Leontes in The Winter's Tale, he notes in horror, I have drunk and seen the spider. It is as terrifying a realization in Saint-Tropez as it is anywhere else. Wow, that sounds like a good excuse not to buy lotto tickets, doesn't it? But it goes to show that cyclic existence is not a matter of how much of the world we own, nor is it somewhere to escape from. Recalling Thupten Chodron's words, Geshe Sonam Rinchen says, cyclic existence is not a place. Places are easy enough to leave. Nor does cyclic existence only affect certain species or groups of people. It affects every ordinary living being. Our lack of understanding is the root of our suffering and is responsible for our troubles. The emphasis placed on education is a sign that it's generally recognized, but the knowledge most educational institutions impart is relevant only to the concerns of this life and therefore cannot help to free us. In the 12-part process through which we remain within cyclic existence, ignorance, craving, and grasping prepare the ground for suffering. Here he's talking about the 12 links of dependent arising, the Buddha's teaching on how the karma we collect in one life leads to existence in a following life. Three of those links are ignorance, the first, craving, and grasping. He continues, ignorance is our confusion regarding the fundamental nature of things, particularly of the self. Without it, the strong sense of I does not arise. Though there is a self, our ignorance magnifies it disproportionately, causing intense disturbing emotions to arise. Focusing on this false self, we are preoccupied with its happiness. Craving is the desire for that happiness, while grasping reaches out for it. These two must be stopped if we are to gain nirvana. How is it done? First, create a good motivation to do what is constructive and turn your mind towards the teachings. Work at decreasing your desires and cultivating contentment. Just this alone would increase your happiness dramatically, whereas the insatiable desire for better friends, lovers, and possessions creates a continual and depressing sense of poverty. A multitude of disturbing emotions and carelessness are responsible for our unwholesome physical actions and speech. Ethical discipline consists of decreasing such actions and the craving to have the best of everything just for ourselves. While these concerns haunt us, our practice will not be genuine, even if we meditate intensively day and night. Pure practice can arise only when we stop craving the ordinary pleasures of this life as well as the joys and comforts of future lives. And so, in line with this, we move to the next verse in the text, which reads, by contemplating the leisure and endowment so difficult to find and the fleeting nature of your life, reverse the clinging to this life. By repeatedly contemplating the infallible effects of karma and the miseries of cyclic existence, reverse the clingings to future lives. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says in his commentary, we need to think about the precious human rebirth that we have with its respites and enrichments, and also about the fact that we will lose it, for it's impermanent, and how death will come for sure. In this way, we will realize how rare the opportunity is that we have now, and how we cannot afford to waste any time. This is how to turn our interest from being only in this life. Dharma is a system of methods to make an unpeaceful mind peaceful and an untamed mind tamed. All of us are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting any suffering, and Dharma is what brings this about. But people do not know how to practice it. If we look at our human bodies, although we might think of them merely in terms of their being in the category or lineage of our parents, if we look more profoundly, we see that they are in a category of having leisures and endowments. Leisures means liberties or freedom to practice the Dharma. And look at us here. We do have the freedom to come here and practice the Dharma, don't we? We're not deaf. We're not missing various faculties that would prevent us from hearing the teachings and so on. We have all the conditions conducive for practice, and whatever is non-conducive is not here. We have, in fact, 8 leisures and 10 endowments. Now, we covered the 8 leisures and 10 endowments in the previous series of programs, but just to remind ourselves, the 8 leisures are freedom from being born in a hell realm, a preta realm, an animal, or long life god realm, or in a place where the Buddha has not appeared, or where the teachings are not available. Also, freedom from being born with wrong views, like there are no past or future lives, and no karmic law of cause and effect, and freedom from being born deaf, dumb, blind, or mentally deficient, as His Holiness suggests. Then the first five of the ten endowments are being born, one, as a human being, two, in a place where the teachings are available, three, having all our sense faculties intact, and four, having faith in the Triple Gem. That's the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Five is not having committed the five heavy actions of killing your mother, father, or an arhat, wounding a Buddha, or creating a schism within the Sangha, all which mean immediate hell rebirth in our next life. The other five are being born in an era when a Buddha, one, has appeared, two, has taught, three, the teachings still flourish, and four, they're followed and practiced, and five, there are supporters and benefactors for practitioners, like retreatants. Then His Holiness continues, many people in the world have a human rebirth, but few have the independence and freedom to practice the Dharma. We're very fortunate, therefore, to have such a rare opportunity. Also, there are spiritual teachers available and present in the world, following the example of the Buddha and carrying on his deeds. These beneficial effects we are experiencing now have resulted from causes similar to them in the past. In other words, our good fortune now must be from constructive causes we have previously enacted. Therefore, to obtain such opportunities and such a working basis again in the future, we need to build up the constructive causes for this now. If we act without attachment, aversion, or naivety, it will not be difficult to build up constructive causes for a precious human rebirth in the future. But in fact, as we rarely act in this way, we need to take as much advantage of the present opportunity as we can. Never be discouraged or feel inadequate. Try to act as constructively as possible. A constructive or tamed mind is not something we can buy in a store, plant in a field, or obtain from a bank. It comes from the actual practice of taming our minds. We need to practice in order to gain meditation experiences and stable realizations. Thus, we need to follow the examples of the great teachers of the past. His Holiness continues, in Tibet, first there were the great Nyingma Lamas. Then afterwards, there were Atisha and the Kadam lineage, the Sakya Lamas and Marpa, Milarepa and Gampapa of the Kagyu lineage, and so on. All of them underwent great difficulties, and by exerting tremendous efforts, they became enlightened. It is just up to us to follow their examples. We need to examine ourselves and ask, what progress have I made in the last 5 years, the last 10, the last 15 years in taming my mind? If we can see that we have indeed made a little improvement, then this can encourage us. Now, don't be proud or anything like that, but if we realize that over 5 or 10 years we can progress a little, then we will not be discouraged over short periods of time. The actual practice is to listen, think, and meditate on the teachings. However, when we hear teachings or study them, we need always to check our attitudes about them. Whatever we hear, we need immediately to put into practice. We need to have our practice of listening, thinking, and meditating never be separate from each other or have any of them missing. Concerning death and impermanence, there are various points upon which to meditate, such as the facts that death is certain, while the time it will come is completely uncertain. Death can happen at any moment, and except for the Dharma, nothing else is of help when it does. If we do not do something now about our forthcoming deaths and future lives, this will not do at all. The more we think of death like this, the more we will lessen our obsession with this life alone. Next, we need to think about the infallibility of the laws of behavioral cause and effect, the laws of karma. To understand behavioral cause and effect in all its details is one of the hardest things. But in a simple form, from good comes good, from bad comes bad. Karma is certain. From constructive actions, happiness is certain to result. From destructive actions, suffering is certain to happen sooner or later. Thus, if we have the causes for suffering on our mental continuums, how can we rest content and be at ease? It's like a time bomb. It's just a matter of time for it sure to go off. If we do not remove this cause, we can never rest at peace. When we think carefully about behavioral cause and effect in this way, we develop the strong wish to remove all the causes of our suffering. At different times, we experience the suffering of birth, death, old age, and sickness. No matter how much medicine we take, we cannot cure old age, and we cannot prevent ourselves from ever becoming sick at all. The sufferings of birth, sickness, old age, and death have their sources in the fact that we have bodies that undergo birth, sickness, old age, and death. Our bodies are networks of tainted, contaminated aggregates. In other words, we receive them tainted with karma and disturbing emotions and attitudes. If we do not rid ourselves of their deepest cause, we will always have suffering. Our bodies are networks of conflicting, contradictory forces. Consider, for instance, the forces of heat and cold in the body. If we have a fever, we take a cooling medicine, and if we take too much, we contract a cold type of disease. If we take a warming medicine to cure ourselves of this chill, and we take too much, then again we tip the scales and have a heat disease. It's only when we have a balance of the heat and cold forces in our bodies that then temporarily we can say we were healthy. But this never lasts. It's very precarious, and at the slightest jolt, the balance is upset. Aryadeva pointed this out in his 400 stanzas. There, he explained that the body is a vessel of contradictory, mutually opposing forces. Thus, it can bring about only problems and suffering. We think that this body is so beautiful, but we need to dissect it in our minds and look at each part separately. Just as the head, for instance, or a strand of hair with a little bulb at the bottom. Look at an ear. Look at an eye just by itself. Look at a piece of skin. Look at a heart. Look at a lung. If they were sitting on the table by themselves, they would all be disgusting and not pretty at all. The same is true regarding the substances that come from this body. Urine, feces, snot, and so on. We see these on the ground when we're walking around and we hold our noses to protect ourselves from their stench. Where did these objectionable substances come from? They've not grown out of the ground. They came from our bodies. How can our bodies be clean when they're just sources of filth? Our bodies come from our parent sperm and eggs. If we were to take these substances, put them on a table in front of us and look at them, any person would feel revolted. We're so attached to them because they become the source of the physical substance of our bodies, yet they themselves are nauseating. If we've lived for 40 years, for instance, think of all the food that we've eaten in those 40 long years on one side, and then all the feces and urine our bodies have turned them into on the other. How can this body be clean if it does such kind of work? We must therefore abandon attachment for such a body. It comes from karma and disturbing emotions and attitudes which only bring suffering. If we exhaust or eliminate the karma and disturbing emotions, we will never again take on tainted aggregates or suffer. And on that note, we must say goodbye to His Holiness for the time being and also the program, for time is up. Please join us again next week. But before we go, let's dedicate all the positive potential we've accumulated today to the enlightenment of all living beings. Thank you. And goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.